And I feel very often that I can detect when people are doing case presentations and so on, this ubiquitous tendency to kind of not bother about the body, you know, at a very superficial level, because somehow it's accepted that we run around in bodies. What is actually a slightly deeper idea is that we run around in bodies, but our minds couldn't have any function at all if our other parts of our functional systems weren't also working. So that the body and mind, of course, are deeply interconnected. You know, we do know that too. That's not news, but it's just that it constantly becomes eliminated.
Welcome to the Psychoanalysis On and Off the Couch podcast. For the past few years, we've been speaking with analysts from around the world who've been applying their analytic way of thinking not only to their offices, but also off the couch in venues external to their consulting rooms. We've spoken to analysts who work in hospitals, in prisons, in community health centers, in refugee clinics, just to name a few. We've also detoured, of course, during COVID. We've spoken with analysts again from around the world to learn from our communities how they, their patients, and the analytic community in general have been dealing with this crisis. And hopefully, the worst is over, and we can return to our main focus. We can return to speaking to analysts who are bringing their skills to people who otherwise would never see the inside of an analyst's office. In addition to that, we're speaking with the elders of our field, people who have been practicing this craft for 40 and 50, sometimes longer years, to learn from them what they have to teach us, not only about this piece of history that we're all living through, but their reflections on our field. Please visit us at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can leave a comment, where you can subscribe. I hope you find these conversations thoughtful and meaningful. And I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Rosemary Balsam. Dr. Balsam has been practicing analysis for over 40 years, and she is a prolific contributor to our field. And she's studied many areas, but a particular focus of hers, which is what we attend to today, is, as the title reflects, is on femaleness and fecundity. The presence of the body in the clinical encounter, in particular the female body, in particular the pregnant female body, in further particularities, the experience of childbirth, she feels is something that has not garnered sufficient analytic attention. It's just assumed in the history and not explored, and she thinks we're missing something in doing that. A bit about Dr. Balsam. She is a training and supervising analyst at the Western New England Institute for Psychoanalysis. She's an associate clinical professor of psychiatry at Yale Medical School. She's on the editorial boards of Psychoanalytic Quarterly and Imago. She has written a book that we discussed today. It's called Women's Bodies in Psychoanalysis. She delivered a plenary address at the American Psychoanalytic. She was the first American woman in 2018 to win the Sigourney Award. She's on the executive board of the newly inaugurated Lowell Center. You get the picture. I could go on. She, if it's in the world of psychoanalysis, Rosemary has done it. And there's much to learn in her teaching, and it's a pleasure for me to have read and reread her work and have the chance to speak with her. We discuss what it's like for both parties in the dyad for bodies to be in the room, sometimes the awkwardness involved. We take up what it means for the father to be in the triangulation of the child, and does he bring his sexual arousal as part of the triangulating process. Fascinating material that we get to. And we also talk about her view of our field, and a bit about her personal journey. I hope you learn as much as I did in this. It was really great fun to chat with her, and I hope you enjoy it as I did. Here's my conversation with Dr. Rosemary Balsam. Rosie, welcome to the podcast. I'm so glad you're here. Rosie, for the past 40 plus years, you have been a prolific contributor to the psychoanalytic community. You are best known, and I think it's fair to say a focus of your attention has been what we titled this podcast as Femaleness and Fecundity. And I thought the best way to introduce your thinking on the subject is for me to read three brief excerpts from things you've written on it. The first two is from your book entitled Women's Bodies in Psychoanalysis. And the third is from your plenary address in 2013 at the American Psychoanalytic Association. The first quote is as follows. Freud may have been wrong about the particulars of female development, but he understood that bodily experience matters to us, and he offered a brilliant opening gambit upon which analysts have been building ever since. Even if phallocentric, he was bracing in his ability to take female sexuality very seriously. Quote number two. It is impossible to think adequately about the mental impact of sensuous and physical pleasures, including their vicissitudes, if the field loses touch with authentic physicality. And the third quote is, only a female body can give birth outside of science fiction. Gender and sexuality may still be unsettled questions in the inner world of any particular individual, but childbirth itself is a pivotal confrontation with a female's owning of her body's sexed maturity. Now, what I understand you to be bringing forward for us to think about is that it is generally recognized that the early analysts were mistaken when they imagined that the little girl essentially perceived herself as phallically deficient. And that mistaken notion left many, both children and later adults, feeling misheard and misunderstood. But my sense of you is that you go further and that you consider that for some, the notion of unrepresented states of mind, which is a current way of thinking, unrepresented states of mind, that too runs the risk of sidestepping the body. And that too, therefore, runs the risk of leaving some people to feel misheard and misunderstood. And what you wrote to me is the following. You said, your aim is to shift the underlying theory to get bodily experience once more as a centerpiece, as Freud had it once. I am placing female genuinely alongside male, as each containing otherness, the otherness of females being most exemplified by pregnancy, and the otherness of males as most exemplified by erections. So, Rosie, let me start us off by asking you to reflect with us. What do you think makes it so difficult for our field to recognize the centrality of the body in clinical thinking, and perhaps especially the female pregnant body?
Well, Harvey, it's wonderful to be here with you, and it's a very delightful opportunity to try to informally expand some on the importance of these ideas, which I am many years in the field, but I'm still passionate about these notions. And I feel very often that I can detect when people are doing case presentations and so on, this ubiquitous tendency to kind of not bother about the body, you know, at a very superficial level, because somehow it's accepted that we run around in bodies. What is actually a slightly deeper idea is that we run around in bodies, but our minds couldn't have any function at all if our other parts of our functional systems weren't also working. So that the body and mind, of course, are deeply interconnected. You know, we do know that too. That's not news, but it's just that it constantly becomes eliminated. The most obvious way that it is eliminated is that if you take case studies, just random stuff from all the journals, and people are constantly reporting their cases. And many cases will start with, you know, this 55-year-old woman, blah, 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 blah. And many things will be attended to in great detail, such as separation anxiety, move she had as a child, so on and so forth. But it'll be glossed over. It'll say she has grown-up children and, you know, two of them are doing well. One is a problem or something. People don't tend to even ask somebody, and this is 50% of the population, after all, and most people, I think 80-some percent of people, fairly recently, women have had children, and that never a question that the analyst seems to occur to. I wonder what sort of experience this person had when she was having children. And even the lack of that kind of attention or interest shows, I think, immediately that there's a lack of understanding of what a tsunamic experience, the whole notion of pregnancy and giving birth, has been to most women. And it has a potential for all kinds of issues, from joys that people have never experienced to traumas such that they never have experienced before and perhaps never will again if they don't have another child. So that a lot of issues of body image change have gone on with somebody who's post-delivery, and a lot of re-alterations of their whole inner world. Not just the bit that we all attend to, which is, what kind of mother is this? Is she has she a nervous attachment to the child? But what's her inner world in relation to her own body as she attends to the child that she has given birth to, which is also viewed by her deeply as a very physical attachment to herself, that she goes through separation. So these, it's actually such a profound experience, I think, that people shy away from it. And
you know what listening to you reminds me of is when the analyst and the analysand, you're talking about really sharing a scotoma. And this has been discovered, this scotoma, in the past regarding traumas. The most obvious one that has often been spoken about is when the analysts came over from Europe after the war, and they just covered over any awareness of the traumas they experienced, and likewise did so for their patients. And you're trying to bring forward an opening of this blindness and saying there's something else that we've been ignoring that is powerful, not necessarily trauma in a terrible sense, but like you said, a tsunami of physical and emotional elements that rarely get taken up or even a focus of interest in an analysis.
I think that that's, now, for example, you're putting that together, that this has a similar form to other traumas, such as the Holocaust trauma and so on. That took me a long time working kind of slowly with people with the recognition of you know, starting at points where a woman patient who might automatically almost feel inferior in some fashion, the early assumption would be that that inferiority necessarily had to do with men. Sometimes that's a more superficial phenomenon than an inferiority actually in relation to her own mother, who often has, the child has had an experience of the mother being pregnant, or that it isn't just the powerful pre-edible mother of the nursery. It's the mother in her body, which is a very magical and changeable and alien kind of, and also the source of great comfort for the child. So these phenomena spark senses of inferiority in a woman whom, if you accept that a woman like a man or a boy like a girl, whatever, are born with a certain kind of sensorium that is going to pick up their own individual kind of body and begin to register that. So that it's more natural, if you will, that a girl is going to pick up the fact that she has genitals, like, and then at some very quick point that somehow she's going to get associated with her mother, even if it's from environmental stimuli that people identify her as a girl and her mother identifies her as a girl and she identifies the two of them as female. So there are many, many factors that go into this. So that's a kind of starting point of something like a challenge to inferiority. So then when you open that up, that opens other things up. So in fact, the root to the kind of experiences actually that I was talking about in my plenary, the remembering the female body, mm-hmm. and about, particularly about childbirth, the root actually to being able to hear much more in depth about that from particular individuals then led me to think, of course, I had appreciated and appreciated personally that these issues are, you know, as you said, you know, tsunami and huge for people. But the idea that other people would turn away from it so quickly, you know, people's notion in childbirth where often a father, I mean, some fathers are very involved, but then some fathers kind of abandon their women when they're in childbirth. Some men become quite violent towards their pregnant partners. There are all kinds of interactions with people that have become encoded that also, and then the, all of the vicissitudes of giving birth. I mean, giving birth is actually, you know, can be glossed over these days as well. Nobody dies and so on. But it actually is a kind of life or birth, life or death kind of situation. Julia Kristeva calls it an emergency. And it's a kind of internal emergency of life or death. And given those issues and the power of it and the intensity, I think I waited till I heard that actually from other people. And that took a long, it took a while to be able to pick up cues so that I could, so that that would help somebody access more of that material. And then eventually I thought, yeah, my God, this can be for so many people, almost as traumatic as kind of becoming an alien in a different country, you know, that they haven't thought before about what kind of, you, it's impossible to think about it in advance, you know, and that it's the process of childbirth, for example.
Your thoughts on it, for me, bring up the question of, do you feel there's a difference with a male analyst or a female analyst? A female analyst can have had children or not, but let's just say they have, just to draw a sharper comparison.
Well, that's a very difficult question. It really is a very challenging, difficult question, and very unsatisfactory. I suppose that I end up saying that I really don't know the answer to that. I think that they're in watching my supervisees and working with them in analysis. Some men are really able to tune into all kinds of bodily things much better than some women, even if they haven't had the experience themselves. They don't happen to be, there are certain kind of people that can happen with both women and men who have an immediate reason, an immediate kind of compulsion to compare themselves to other people, you know, so that if it didn't happen to them, almost, well, then they have no right to, you know, as if it's prying into somebody else's experience to find out what happened to the other person physically. But other people are somehow more broadly curious. And I think that, I suppose in general, one could say that having had an experience, it makes it easier to tune into it. But it doesn't necessarily mean that that attunement will be perfect with that particular patient anyway. I mean, that all has to be worked at. So I don't know the answer, Harvey, I think.
Okay, fair enough. I just wanted to put the question on the table because I think it's on many of our minds.
Yeah, I think that the quality of, I always think of like Hans Lowaldt's kind of the closest thing that he got to thinking about mental health would be a tremendous flexibility of mind that comes with people who are more fully developed in certain ways, not necessarily mature, but they have more capacity for breadth of imagination. And there are some men who are very artistic that way and really much more able to than some women who are quite constricted. And they're not able to sort of go there, as it were. So.
Your focus is, though, broader than just on the scotoma of around childbirth. It's around the body in general and as it lives in the mind, on the couch. And another point you make, which I share with you, that is that it is not only the analyst's body that is often overlooked, or their relationship literally with their physicality, but also the permission for the analyst to discover his or her imagination about the analyst's body. So often I see either in supervision or in reanalyses where that whole realm of imagination and experience and freedom is overlooked. And this is something you've noted as well.
You know, it's, yes, I do feel that it's a crucial part. It's part of, you know, my kind of thinking about that, the centrality, it's the centrality of the changing sex body from kind of infancy to maturity that is such a central part of everybody's subjective experience, along with all these internalizations and the environmental stimuli that the, you know, that has contributed to that and the representation in their minds. So that it therefore becomes like, why would people leave it out? You know, the environment.
Fair question, right? Well, I suspect because it's somewhat, it's awkward, potentially awkward, that is to the extent that one is not in one's full analytic listening mode and is in a personal mode, it can be difficult to hear challenges, dislikes, inadequacies, et cetera, critiques of one's body, no matter how reverie-like one is. What do you think?
Well, you know, that's absolutely true, you know, and if you hear somebody telling you, you know, that you have a fat backside, it's not the pleasantest thing from the narcissistic point of view. On the other hand, you know, it's also a nugget of great interest, you know, if you're also thinking about, well, this person actually has a sort of a nice upfront freedom here, and that the remembrance that you and this person have contributed to this moment, you know, that softens the blow, as it were.
Yeah, that there's a gift being shared, the gift of a freedom of their thought, exactly. Is how I see it.
Exactly. I think, you know, that makes it together with the analyst and then more possible and even kind of a really interesting place to go. And not, you know, you have to do a lot of spade work, I think psychological spade work around this business about, you know, are you going to hurt somebody else? And people are often like really worried about that. And, you know, one way that I handle some of that, I mean, sometimes it's successful, sometimes it's not, you know, but to acknowledge their concern about me is a nice thing, you know, and point out that socially is a nice characteristic, mm-hmm, that you worry about hurting somebody. However, we have to remember that, you know, we're working together here, and that also the only way that I have to try to understand is to try to get as close, for them to try to get as close to free association, you know, with not being so worried about hurting whoever the interlocutor is. And I know that it's a kind of acknowledgement both to ourselves as analysts, I think, and to everybody else, that it's a pretty weird setup, you know.
Oh, isn't it? Yes, of course. Yeah. And I think it is important to acknowledge how odd it is. Right.
Yes. But then, you know, the patient becomes more free at the notion that we all can acknowledge that it's weird if you're only thinking socially. And then, you know, but it has a purpose. It has a function. It's not just because it's weird we want to do it, you know. So
you mentioned the openness of thinking, and you also mentioned Lowold. And I know he's been a very important person to you. Can you say something about who he is to you and what he's brought to your analytic mind?
Yes, well, you know, Hans Lowold was, I was in supervision with him for, he was one of my longest supervisees. In fact, I'm a kind of big believer in people working on their own. And, you know, as soon as they feel confident enough, because I think that analysts, you know, candidates have been previous analysts, and anything that sort of encourages their autonomy and so on, and then their freedom to think and to be able to notice things without being scrutinized all the time, you know, sometimes promotes a lot of interesting and good ideas. Mm-hmm. So Hans, it was unusual for me to hold on to an analyst like this, to Hans. And he said to me, you know, you can really do this on your own. So he sort of kicked me out of it. But it was only about a year after I graduated, to be fair. But he's, I loved his sense of, I think one of the things that I stand for, and probably is part of an internalization with him too, is try not to pathologize everything as soon as you hear it, you know, and put it into categories of, you know, well, this is such a narcissistic patient, I'm not sure I can work with this person. Because he would foster discussion really about the fascinations of narcissism. These are developmental issues that people are bringing, and the way and the source that they bring them. Hans's great interest in language, I felt I share that very much. I mean, it was there long before I met Hans, but that he happens to be an analyst who loved language and the representation of things in language and how they were, and maintained a kind of fascinated interest, while one was talking about patients and we'd look for things together. I really, really enjoyed talking with him, and I also felt extremely free. He was very much of a kind of old-fashioned European gentleman professor, and I loved my old-fashioned gentleman professors when I was in medical school. And he was like that in the sense that he wasn't, all over you and like trying to be friendly and hyper reaching out or anything. It's like he was there and you went to him, and then you sort of sourced his interests and his profound intelligence through conversation and focusing on the patient. And I found him to be he would go places that I didn't have the nerve to. For example, I brought a patient to him once. This was a medical student who did Lofi clinic patient, and had been referred to me as a control case. And as soon as the guy came into my office, to my ear, he really sort of fell apart. And he told me about how suicidal he was on the highway and all kinds of things. And I really lost my nerve. And I did find out a lot of other things about him. But, when I went to Hansen, Hans said his main diagnostic category was, well, he really let his hair down with you, didn't he?
Huh.
However, his attitude then was more, well, what do you want to do? Do you want to go there or do you not want to go there? And I felt like I didn't have the emotional energy to go there. I had a small child at the time and so on, and I didn't want to be up at night, trying to hospitalize people in the emergency room and stuff. Uh-huh. And I did believe what I heard, and I still do, that analysis, when it goes well, is a regressive form of treatment. So that, if this guy was willing to tell me all this and, while sitting up and looking at me, I was sort of frightened to take it on at that particular time in my life. I thought, well, later, but not that. And he was fine with that. We'll get another patient, And, as long as care of the patient. I did, of course, take care of the patient to refer to somebody else.
You mentioned your time in medical school, and my sense of you is that you love being a physician. You certainly love being an analyst, but in addition to that, that your physicianhood is very important to you. Can you say something about that?
Yeah, it is important to me, not the issue about whether you're called doctor or not makes no difference. It's to do with the study of medicine, which is so fascinating to have. I felt it so incredibly interesting, I'm very much in awe of the human body and it's all the sort of physiology and anatomy and way that everything works together or doesn't, or, it's just an endlessly fascinating study. So that's how I loved it. And I always, I was interested in biology, interested in I like the turn to psychiatry and psychoanalysis because I like writing and I like literature. And, you know, I always was taught in medical school that it's really the person and how they live their lives and what their environment is, that you can't just take the body and the sickness out of the whole environment. So I think that I was influenced by being taught in those ways. And I loved it. I was, I wanted to do medicine for a long time. I had, my mother was, a big influence, I guess. She was a very interesting, she was a terrific person actually. And very, she was an old nurse, in the sense of being kind of like Florence Nightingale, practically. She was quite old when I was born, like she was 43 or something. And I would laugh after and say, oh, weren't you worried I'd be Down syndrome? And she, oh, not at all, not at all. No, I mean, she didn't worry for some reason. But she was full of stories from the old days in hospitals, and she absolutely loved her nursing career. And she described everything in such really terrifically interesting detail, and everything was kind of functional in terms of, you know, she would talk about the patients she had nursed, and she would talk about her work in the operating room. And she also had the opportunity, which, you know, looking back was pretty fabulous. She did her midwifery and gynecology in the Rotunda Hospital in Dublin, which was the major European center in those days. Now, I'm talking the 1920s. And she also nursed people in the rebellion. So she would tell me, you know, when people come in and they're injured, and, you know, it's important. I mean, she knew from first principles, like we all bleed, and, you know, that there'd be no differentiation between Protestants and Catholics when people are in the hospital. And so she stood for a lot of things that, and a kind of excitement about life in the hospital. And I envisioned that, of course. And I used to say when I was little, I want to be a nurse. I'd like to be a nurse. She said, I know. She said, you don't want to be a nurse. She said, you'll have more education. She said, you'll have more autonomy, more power. If you're a doctor, you can do whatever you want. So that was her notion. I think that was the source of her encouragement. And also my father was very encouraging. He loved the idea that I would want to go to medical school. You know, he played his part too.
Hearing you describe, as beautifully as you are, your sense of her and your rhythm together, you have mentioned to me a study, and tell me if I have this right, that you are either in the middle of or planning to take a group of men who did not have mothers who, let's say for shorthand, thought well of them, and a group of women who had mothers who did think well of them. And despite the gender, where theoretically one might think that the men would think better of themselves just because they're male, and the women might think poorly of themselves just because they're female, you anticipate that that will not be the case, that the key variable is who their mothers were and what the relationship was. Does that characterize?
It does, but it dignifies it too much, Harvey, in terms of a study. It's not something I'm planning. I mean, it's not something that would be far from my mind. But I think I referred to, I did write a paper about, it was part of my fascination with siblings and how siblings are treated. And I have a several, quite a lot of stuff in the literature about siblings. And of course, my focus on siblings would always be to do with siblings of different sexes and genders are more interest to me, and how they're treated in the families and what is there. So that it was from that kind of focus that I did happen to, you know, if I have actually had the good fortune to analyze a lot of people. I think it's partly the, you know, being around the university town, and people around universities are often quite interested in navel gazing, you know, the way we are. And it's perhaps easier to find patients who are fellow navel gazers, if that's what you're looking for. I mean, if that happens to be something you're interested in, you know, rather than using psychoanalysis in a different way to kind of really address very people in very problematic social circumstances and so on. But in any case, I did have a series of men whose mothers really kind of diminished them, were very, very hard on them, and did everything, it seemed to me, in their power to undermine their masculinity, and seemed to really hate their bodies. Sometimes men, I have a kind of an e-book called something like Sons of Passionate Mothering. And those are the opposite kinds of characters. Where
this is a book you wrote that's available on ebook.
It's an ebook. So Jason Aronson.
First I hear of it.
Yeah. I know it doesn't appear very much, and I actually don't even think I have it in my CV. But Jason Aronson made a book out of it, on an ebook from a kind of a long paper I had written on it, and. These are boys whose mothers adore their bodies when they're very young, you know, as long as they're kind of little choir boys, or their vision of being kind of asexual and just devoted in a more dependent way on mother, that these boys are cherished. But God help them once they begin to develop hair on their chest or... Mm-hmm. Or develop their penises, or the mother discovers a wet dream or something. It's then, you know, gradually all sorts of denigration begins to break loose and so on. So
when they no longer function as an extension of her?
Well, when they no longer are more like girls, I think, in the mother's mind, the girl is less sexual. And, you know, this is not the case at all, as we know. Of course, girls are quite homoerotic and very sensual, very sensual. But in these early forms, these proto forms of sexuality, they, little boys are, you know, they can, the mother can still look at them more in terms of being babies. And I think that it's more tolerable. So anyway, that's another form. There's many different forms of mothering. I think that's a kind of a half unexplored territory, to tell you the truth, that there's, you know, sometimes when you read psychoanalytic theory, you'd think that mothering was just like one thing, you know, either it's bad or it's good, or it only has these powerful primitive fantasies. There's a lot more to mothering than the powerful primitive fantasies. You know, there's a lot of evolution of different forms of autonomy and hatred. And actually, that's why I also like the Laplanchian outlook on the whole kind of duet between the mother and the child, and how that builds the Oedipus complex and so on.
And you contributed something that, to my knowledge, was brand new on this topic, and that is the father's role in this mother-child or mother-infant dyad. It's well known that there is a value in a triangulating function, and that triangulating function is often, not necessarily always, but often assigned to the father. And this was part of a conversation Michael Diamond and I had in our conversation about the development of masculinity. But you add something special. And in your book, you talk about the importance of the father's sublimated use of his sexual arousal to serve as the engine that helps the toddler become separate from the mother. Can you say more about that? Because it's such a novel notion.
Yeah, I must talk to Michael about that. I love Michael's work, incidentally. You can see why I think we're on the same wavelength.
Yes.
I'm pretty empirical in my approach to a lot of things. And this was kind of material that I noticed in with a very gifted patient. That's how it started. That's how it often starts. If you have a patient some patients are kind of gifted, more associated, mm-hmm. with more ease of the atmosphere of that. And somebody who is a very good observer of themselves and their body can actually open your eyes to a lot of things that go on that are very interesting and that you wouldn't necessarily have thought about yourself. But however, I was always puzzled by this thing about, you know, why fathers are assumed to be the breakers of the kind of intense bond between a mother and child. For one thing, it's assumed there, this is a sidebar, but it goes associatively along with the so-called the pre-Oedipal era. And the pre-Oedipal era has been used, I think, in psychoanalysis in a negative sort of way, as if people are not developed if they're too involved in a so-called pre-Oedipal issue, which has to do with the separation, merger, individuation, that whole kind of arena. And it was assumed that somehow mothers are the queens in that area, and that fathers somehow, you know, this thing, I think it maybe came from Stoller about the disidentification, was so necessary and all of that, which is sort of rubbish. Right. I mean, it happens, but it happens with women too. You know, it's not unique to men, and it's also not a necessary part, I think, of the whole process. But in any case, why I was puzzled, you know, why would people assume that men who are, there are plenty of men that have been on my couch that have a lot of merger and so on, fantasies just the same way as women do. Mm-hmm. That it is part of archaic, and it's part of natural, it's all sort of part of experience in the human mind, really, at a working and a different layer of integration. Just so, why would they be assumed to kind of be so on top of this thing about individuation when I didn't necessarily see it that way, having seen many on the couch? So this young man, who was a primary nurturing father, told me a lot about his body in relation to his infant daughter and his, you know, how obviously seductive in that childlike proto-sexual way that especially little girls can be with men, and she was a gorgeous little creature, and he adored her, and vice versa. And he, you know, he giving her baths, he noticed that he was having erections. And at first he was upset, you know, at the very beginning, he would say, oh my God, maybe I'm a pedophile. Am I a pedophile? And then we, kind of obviously got much more into that in a literal way, you know, pedo, well, of course it's arousal by a child, but it sort of doesn't it depend what you do with that, whether you're going to actually be a pedophile or not. But that this is part of a process that seems to go on quite a lot between men and their children and also their boy children.
Yes.
That they're aroused, but that it means, I noticed then, and he noticed, as this little girl grew up, because I had the good fortune to start with him when she was like a year old, and we worked till she was about 7 or 8, and he began to bring her to ballet and gymnastics, and so that the child could really then show off very much for him. And it preserved, I thought, her joy in her body and his reciprocal interaction with her. It preserved his joy too, and also allowed him to feel safe with whatever private levels of arousal he had. So I thought that, I listened then, of course, to more men, and I felt that I heard it enough times, so I thought, yeah, well, that makes sense to me. You know, that could be part of it, because women, women's arousal is so much more kind of, you know, you like if you have an erection with a 2-year-old and you're the dad, you know, the child's going to see that, and you know, you therefore presumably are more concerned about it, whereas if you're a woman and you feel sexually aroused while you're bathing your child, the child isn't, you know, child doesn't really notice. Nobody notices. Everybody can sort of feel more comfortable with it.
Yeah. There's so much more I want to ask you about this. And there's a piece in your book that I'm just going to offer as a teaser to anybody who wants to read about it. It's your notion that there is for men the hormodana split in relation to women, you've written about for women the beast and the baby split in relation to men. But we don't have time to go into that. That's just to intrigue people to read it in your book, because I want to ask you a couple of more things. First of all, you've been doing this, as we said, for 40 plus years. You are an elder in our field. Give us your sense of where we've been and dare say where you think we're going.
Well, you know, where we've been actually has been many places. there's a kind of mythology, some more simplistic mythology that somehow we were in a bad place and now we're in a good place, which has to do with notions of theory, you know, which are much more open to the archaic and much more wide-ranging and valuable, really, in total terms than it used to be. And so in that sense that we're doing well. And then in the other sense, which is the direct opposite of that, people used to have patients, potential analyst ends, you know, lining up in queues waiting for them when they were candidates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where have they all gone? You know, where have all the flowers gone? And so therefore we're not doing well, and there's too much competition in the environment with, you know, in pharmacology and cognitive behavioral stuff and so on and so forth. So I actually sort of feel a little bit aloof from that in terms of being able to make sort of good and bad contrasts. My contrast is more with, I mean, I was born and bred in the National Health Service in the UK. And in England and the UK, there actually is very little analysis. They, you know, the great analysts and all that are in London are, London is the main kind of mecca. And, you know, you might note that there aren't a ton of institutes in England. And there are societies now, and great, and Northern Ireland has an analytic society, and it's great. But the notion that in America, there were so many people that must have felt, that did feel, that analysis was the panacea, and it was kind of sold to them that way in some fashion. And then, of course, they discovered that it wasn't, among other things. I just have to put in my own sense of where my work would fall into that, is that I think that this thing about penis envy, for example, that people were so insistent on, they knew for sure what was wrong with these women, that was such a turnoff for so many women. That you hear that in the writings of the 1970s and the first wave of feminism and so on. And, then analysis had to be reclaimed again for women by people like Juliette Mitchell and, to reassert where analysis fits in and how important Freud is and so on. So I think we lost a lot of clients through our mm-hmm. theories that way, even though those were not parts of the theory that people that were popular to criticize. There's a lot of issues about that. But I think that analysis has actually fallen into, and it may be biased by our life at the Western New England more, but that I think it's in a place where it's a kind of subspecialty. It takes a very long time to become an analyst, and we work very slowly. And, as Freud said, for a miracle, it's much too slow. And, it's against the pace of modern life. And all the derivations, if you will, of the most extreme forms of analysis are very useful in everyday life. And, some of the ones that insurances will pay for. I do think we should keep fighting for trying to get analysis paid for, because it is a kind of, it's not everybody who wants analysis. And for the people who want it and the people who can benefit from it, it should be certainly supported by the government and insurance. However, even though it appears to be diminished, I think it's actually, it's such a powerful tool that Freud gave us, and also in opening up to other disciplines. And I love the way that the psychoanalytic world in my time has opened up more to, although it's hard for people like course candidates, it's very hard for them to get any kind of, enough sort of patient exposure to be able to really get into doing analysis. There's a lot to try to do to help them. But still, there's a life in the academy for analysis. There's a life within our teaching worlds. There's a life for many people who really, really can benefit from analysis. And there's a life in our world for people like me who just love doing analysis.
And that's where we are. That's where I want to close our conversation. That smile you just had about how you love this. Tell us about you, and not just your love of analysis, but this particular area of the woman, the body, the pregnancy, the granular attention to these things that is so vital in your thinking. What brings you to that?
Well, to start off with the end point, the granular attention is something that grew. It's a subject matter that it sort of grows itself. It's like, like an endless pregnancy itself, maybe. It sort of grows because the more you're into it, the more you can open up other parts of it. Like we just briefly touched on that stuff about men and erections and other things that you haven't noticed, you haven't really thought about. So that part of it. But the more macroscopic part of my interest, I kind of backed into it, though I think I was primed for it by the relationship with my mother. And also, I grew up on the land. We had one of those big houses on the land, and, you know, we had animals, the horses and cows and stuff like that, you know, with a lot of beautiful landscapes. And I guess we played a lot in nature, in the woods, and, you know, we're very aware of nature all the time. And, I spent a lot of time with our cousins and friends and everything. We used to come to our house for their school vacations and whatnot, and we would just endlessly spend our time exploring things in the woods and animals. And so there's a lot of birthing and one thing or another going on all the time. So mm-hmm. It seemed like the whole notion of nature is very kind of personal for me. And that's one of the things that I love about Hans's writing. If you read this book on sublimation, particularly his last book on sublimation, it feels to me personally incredibly inspiring to think of ourselves as part of nature and our egos and our autonomy as very hard-won achievements of individuality, but that we're sort of extracting ourselves out of the environment and out of nature all the time into this world of individuality and so on that our minds and brains are also focused on with companionability and attachments and reproduction and all that kind of thing. So I think I was primed in some way. And then I had an early experience of writing my book, Becoming a Psychotherapist. This is a book that has been on the market since 1974, a clinical primer. It did very well, I might say. And this was long before I was even thinking about being an analyst. My first husband, unfortunately, died of cancer. And the publisher, Little Brown, asked me if I would finish the book that he had started. And I tried to write like him, and it was a total failure. So I just wrote like myself. I like Virginia Woolf and A Room of Her Own and A Voice of Her Own. Yeah, everything. You know, it's like good to write and satisfying. And I think it was part of my mourning process, probably, to write the first chapter. It's one of the first chapters in the literature about the pregnant therapist in 1974. So I wrote about my own pregnancy, and Roy Schaefer was my supervisor for those. This was in student health services in the 1970s, not too long after Yale became co-ed, which had been another stirring whole thing about the awareness of students, their female students, and first, you know, a lot of social turmoil there and feminist issues coming up. And for the first time into the student health service, there would also come pregnant women. And then somehow I was very interested, because I was pregnant myself, I would listen for what, my students, it seemed natural to me to listen to what they thought about it and how they perceived it and what it meant to them and their own mothers and their own siblings and stuff. So that was a process of kind of backing into writing about it. And then I suppose that encouraged me to go on.
Mm-hmm. There's so much more I want to talk to you about, but for now we have to stop. I do want to express my appreciation for the clarity of your thinking. The next word that comes to mind besides clarity is the courage of your thinking. What you say, and you say it both respectfully but autonomously, is really your own voice. It goes back to one of the first quotes I read, where you honor Freud's thinking. You're hardly a Freud basher, but you also honor his limitations and go on and share your thoughts about it. And it isn't often where one can do both as beautifully as you do. And that's one of my take-home experiences, that to be able to do just that, to honor the people before us and carry forward around their limitations, which you have done so beautifully, and you have entered your voice into our literature, our world, and I dare say into all of our consulting rooms. I think we all listen differently, listen better. I know I certainly did when I reread your book. And I'm sure that's going to be the case for many people listening to this. So thank you. Thank you for that. And thank you for sharing time with us today.
Can I say thank you to you too? I think you're a wonderful,
sure.
wonderful reader. And it's a pleasure to talk with you and interact with you. And I was thinking as you were talking, a quote from Roy Schaeffer, who used to say, it takes hard work to appreciate hard work. And I really feel quite appreciated. Thank you so much.
You're kind. Thanks so much, Fred. Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.